I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our ongoing conversation about poverty and opportunity. It's called Chasing the Dream. On this show, we're going to discuss the future of work and what it means for those Americans and those Hoosiers who struggle to gain or maintain a toehold. My guests are Jessica Fraser, Program Manager with the Institute for Working Families, and Dr. Marquita Walker of the IUPUI School of Social Work. Please join this important conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are today on No Limits continuing our conversation about poverty and opportunity. The overall title of this ongoing conversation is Chasing the Dream. Today, specifically, we're going to be talking about the future of work and what it means in terms of people who are struggling to gain a toehold or to maintain one. If you'd like to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guest today is Jessica Fraser, who is the program manager for the Institute for Working Families. We should be joined shortly by Dr. Marquita Walker, the IUPUI School of Social Work. She's in labor studies. So, Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
It's good to have you here. Probably ought to start, because I think to get at this subject and to understand why we're talking about this, you know, most of the numbers we are seeing right now in earlier ages would not have made a whole lot of sense. Indiana has pretty close to record employment numbers now. We've got, as Governor Pence and his team routinely remind Hoosiers, there are more Hoosiers working than ever before in the state's history. Unemployment is somewhere around 5%, which is pretty close to just what it would be naturally, because you'd have people. And yet, we're still seeing poverty rates either maintain or, in some cases, increase, despite the fact that we have pretty close to full employment. Normally, jobs meant an end to poverty.
Right.
They don't seem to right now. Why is that?
Right. Well, I think part of the problem is the quality of the jobs that are making up our economy right now. So when you look at the jobs that employ the most Hoosiers, mm-hmm. the top 20 jobs that employ the most Hoosiers, only three of them pay enough on the median for a family of three to be self-sufficient. So only three occupations out of the top 20 in terms of employing Hoosiers pay enough for a family of three to be self-sufficient.
We are joined now by Dr. Marquita Walker, who is with the IUPUI School of Social Work. Dr. Walker, welcome to the program. Marquita, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can now. Yes, this is good.
Okay.
This is good.
Great.
Well, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Jessica, which is the numbers we sort of see right now, and in earlier eras wouldn't have made a whole lot of sense when we'd see, you know, record numbers of jobs should have meant, if not an end to poverty, at least a decrease in the numbers. We're not seeing that right now. In fact, the two seem to be marching hand in hand. Why is that?
Well, there are a number of reasons that there have been a decline in the wages for working Hoosiers, as for other workers across the United States and worldwide. And that is simply a move from a manufacturing economy to a service sector economy. And service sector workers tend to make less wages. They tend to receive fewer benefits. And so those folks that are relegated to service industry jobs are often in poverty more so than those who used to make a pretty good, decent living from a higher manufacturing wage. There are other reasons for that as well, which we may be getting into later on in the program. But one of the basic reasons is a move from manufacturing jobs to the service sector industry.
Well, and we see as we make this transition, the, a lot of those service jobs are, do tend to be low wage, but there's clearly a demand for them in pure economic theory, the fact that there's a demand for them.
As we move into a two-tiered economy where we have financial industry and banking sector industry positions that require financial capitals, such as larger cities, there are required spaces for individuals to travel to these cities in order to stay all night in hospitality suites and conduct business here. And so that has certainly increased the number of service sector workers. So it's really a two-pronged division between wages. We have very high wages often going to folks in the financial industry, and then we have lower wages going to those workers who provide the necessary hospitality services that these visitors to Indianapolis and other large cities enjoy as well.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the future of work. This is part of our ongoing conversation called Chasing the Dream, Explorations of Poverty and Opportunity in the United States and in Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Jessica, what we're talking about here, and we've talked about this on this program before, you know, it goes by many terms, the one that that Marquita Walker just used, the two-tier economy. Other places they refer to it as an hourglass economy where you have a lot at the top and a lot at the bottom and not much in the middle. I'd like to talk about what the implications have been for the people at the bottom of that hourglass or on the lower tier.
Sure. So I think, you know, what the implications have been are what you talked about, rising poverty, rising income inequality, low income folks that have that pay those or work those low wage jobs. They tend to have less access to public benefit programs that people at the higher end enjoy. So they may not have access to health care provided by their employer. They don't have access to sick days. Most low wage workers don't have a single sick day to take care of themselves or a loved one. They probably don't have paid family leave. About only 5% of low wage workers nationally have access to paid family leave. And so, you know, they're really trapped in this horrible situation of trying to, you know, go about their daily business, taking care of themselves and their family with little to no resources to be able to make those things happen.
And Marquita, when we are talking about the development of this two-tiered economy, the folks at the base seem to be at some level without, you know, leverage or whatever to change things. Is this a trend that is likely to accelerate? And if so, what are the implications of that?
I think the trend is likely to accelerate. This trend started back in the early 70s. We have the advent of globalization, which allowed workers worldwide to be able to accept jobs that traditionally were only held in the United States. And so anything that could be digitized was digitized and was able to be performed in other countries, particularly Mexico and China and other places around the world whose workers simply work for less wages. And so we have American workers who have always been the most productive workers in the world. But back in 1972, you saw a decrease in American wages and an increase in worker productivity. And that trend has continued. And much of that has been exacerbated by the globalized effect of the privatization of the workforce, the deunionization of the workforce, and the deregulation of industry. And so when industry isn't regulated as it should be, we have workers who often find themselves in these very low-wage, precarious jobs because they have no protections. Perhaps the union, which initially protected them as a representative bargaining agent, is no longer able to do that. Perhaps it's been decertified. Perhaps any number of things could have happened, but the deunionization of the workforce has certainly also contributed to the inability of low-wage workers to gain a foothold in this economic balance of power between labor and between management. Right now, that balance of power is very much in favor of corporations. And so when you strip workers of their rights to collectively bargain or to try to balance out their economic position with corporations, and that's often done through legislation, it's very difficult for workers to be able to earn a living wage or be able to take jobs that might provide sustainable living for themselves and their families. So what these workers are faced with is an illusion of choice, even though we function under a contract at will employment relationship in most states, and we currently do that in Indiana as well with the new right to work laws. We have workers who can't take high-paying jobs, perhaps because they don't have the skill, perhaps because they don't have the education, but also because those jobs simply don't exist. And so this illusion of choice is prevalent in our low-wage economy. And we see that in Indianapolis and particularly in the service sector.
We have, we're talking about the future of work as part of our ongoing conversation, Chasing the Dream. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Fran has done and find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI. Fran asked the question, says, thanks for having two great advocates like Jessica and Marquita on the show. Can they speak to whether or how much we need collective government social support in areas of health care, child care, etc., to compensate for lower wages and less secure employment? Jessica, I'm going to throw that one to you first.
Sure. I think we absolutely need to start thinking about that. And the time to think about that is now, as we're starting to move to what some people call an on-demand economy or a gig economy with, you know, Uber drivers and Airbnb.
Yeah, I want to talk. I'm going to let you finish your point, but I do think we have to talk also about the Uberization of the economy.
Sure.
And what that means. But
so, you know, when we start thinking about that shift of business risk and workplace responsibilities from the employer to the employee, we're going to have to make policy solutions that fill in the gap in a systemic way, because workers are not going to be able to absorb that en masse.
And is you know, in terms of where the pressures are going to be, is healthcare, child care the top priorities, or are there other areas?
I would say that child care, and I would put transportation as the second top priority. Child care,
oh, okay.
And transportation.
So and the subject of a previous Chasing the Dream, when we were talking about the importance of mass transit when it comes to dealing with questions of helping the working poor. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the future of work as part of our ongoing conversation, Chasing the Dream. That's an exploration of poverty and opportunity in America and in Indiana. My guests are Jessica Fraser. She is a program manager for the Institute for Working Families, and Dr. Marquita Walker, who is with the IUPUI School of Social Work. She's in labor studies. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are on today's No Limits continuing our conversation called Chasing the Dream. It's an exploration of the issues of poverty and opportunity in American life and in Indiana. Today, specifically, we're talking about the future of work. My guests are Jessica Fraser. She is a program manager for the Institute for Working Families, and Dr. Marquita Walker is with the IUPUI School of Social Work in Labor Studies. Marquita, I want to throw this one to you. We alluded to it right before we went to the break, where we talked about what, for lack of a better term, I'm going to call the Uberization of the American economy or the American workforce, where increasingly it's about people becoming less permanent employees of a specific entity that provides you with wages and, in theory, benefits and helps you plan for your retirement and all of that, to situations where all of that devolves down to one person, and you're sort of left to fend for yourself when it comes to the question of benefits and retirement planning and all of that. Is that the future of work as we know it? Increasingly, is that what our economy is going to look like?
Well, we certainly hope that's not the future of work, because that's not a very promising future. This has trying to push all of the responsibilities for work onto the worker has been going on for a long time. Uberization, I think, is the latest term applied to that. It has also been called just-in-time process or the gig economy. And what that means is simply the responsibility for everything devolves to the worker. We used to, in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and up until we moved into the knowledge-based economy, had corporations who valued their employees enough that they provided for them benefits in the form of pensions and insurance and perhaps other benefits as well, vacation time, holiday pay, because that made for a better and a more productive employee. The cost of those things have risen, and so corporations have tried to shift that cost back to the worker. And many workers are unable to bear the brunt of that cost because they simply don't make enough money per hour or month or year. So what really has to happen for this economy to turn around and do things that are in the long-term best interest of not only workers and corporations as well, is to provide for workers decent benefits, a good paycheck. There is no downside to a good paycheck. Because once a worker is able to support his or her family in a reasonable standard of living, they become less reliant on social transfer payments, which are those benefits given by the government and derived from taxpayer dollars. And so what corporations do is shift the cost that they would incur in paying those benefits to the taxpayer, and in the form of social transfer payments. And so the taxpayers are really supporting a great deal of the cost for workers that worker or that the corporation should bear. And so it's really a disservice to taxpayers for corporations to do that. So I'm hopeful that with good policy in place and with the realization that the labor management economic power balance is out of whack and legislation should move toward promoting workers' rights and not entirely toward promoting property rights, that the Uberization or the just-in-time or the gig economy can be turned around. This isn't an inevitable decline, but there does have to be policy in place, and it starts at the policy level. It starts with legislation. It starts with putting legislators in office that will help protect workers. That's not just an Indiana problem. That's a problem in most of the United States.
We are talking about the future of work as part of our conversation, Chasing the Dream, here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Patrice has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Patrice, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Certainly.
I wanted to make a comment about what our state legislature has done to salaries of public school teachers. I'm a retired public school teacher of 33 years, and I watched the last 7 or 8 years how they have demoralized public education and teachers. They've stripped teachers' unions of almost all the ability to bargain. When I left, I was at the top of the scale in Vigo County. I have my master's degree. I got it many years ago. You used to be rewarded for your years of experience on top of possibly getting a raise. If your school corporation could afford that, you would be rewarded for getting a master's degree, a doctorate degree. When I left, I was making nearly $70,000 a year. When the Republicans took a lot of that away, I saw many young, promising teachers just in my building alone leave teaching to go back to school, to get possibly a nursing degree, whatever kind of degree could give them some respect and a decent living wage. I most recently, in our newspaper here in Terre Haute, a wonderful chemistry teacher in the school I was last in decided to leave, a young man who has a young family, because he got into law school. You can't make a living or support a family with only $38,000 a year. Many school corporations are not able to give raises or very decent raises right now because of the property tax caps. So it's been very disheartening to me as a 33-year retired teacher, or a person who taught for 33 years. Now I've been retired for 2 years, about the denigration of public education and teachers. When people make a decent living, they put that money back out into the economy. I don't know how difficult that was for Republicans to understand that. And so they were so shocked in the last year or two when schools are struggling to find teachers and can't have enough teachers. When the school year starts, they're just absolutely stunned by that. It's been their own doing, And now what they've done is they've decided to give away more taxpayer dollars to incentivize young people to become teachers. We're going to give you X amount of dollars a year towards your tuition as long as you stay a teacher for 5 years. Is that all we want from our teachers? Stay for 5 years? I'm sorry. Very disappointing to me.
Thanks very much for the call and for the comments, Patrice.
Yes. I love your program. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Well, and I want to talk, because this is, it's ironic at some level that the young man she referenced is going to law school, because obviously the legal profession has had some of the same challenges. Jessica, I want you to talk a little bit about what this has done to kind of the implied social contract that we all live by, that if you work hard and you follow the rules, in theory there's going to be a place for you and you're going to get ahead and you will have a good life. That's at least one definition of the American dream. We're seeing in places like this that there are a lot of previously respected professions where that just does not happen anymore. No matter how hard you work, no matter how many rules you follow, there is a chance you're going to be disposable and the bottom will just fall out for you.
Sure. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack in those comments, but I think government jobs, public sector jobs for a long time, and I think Dr. Walker can probably talk even more, even better about this, were, you know, a huge part of what made up our middle class. And so as from sort of the political spectrum, we've sort of started thinking about how much government spending do we want to have? How many government employees do we want to have? What size of government are we comfortable with? We've really reduced the roles of those public sector employees that were good middle class jobs. And the caller is absolutely right when she talks about the consumer driven economy. The majority of our economy is dependent on consumer spending. And so if we don't put into the economy, if, you know, folks aren't making good enough wages to be able to, you know, take care of their basic needs, save a little for retirement, aspire to a middle class lifestyle, that's going to, you know, sort of weaken and hamper our economy on the larger scale. So I think that, you know, as we keep moving towards this two-tiered economy with a lot of folks at the top and not as many on the bottom, and a lot on the bottom and not as many in the middle, we're going to tip over. Mm-hmm. If we don't start trying to think about how do we draw the line in the sand and put some of those pieces of the social contract back in place.
Marquita, is this a problem that is peculiar to the United States, or is the rest of the developed world dealing with some of these same trends or forces?
This is not a problem that is unique to Indiana nor the United States. This is a global problem in most industrialized developed countries. And the reason for that is the move toward the privatization of everything. Sometimes we demonize corporations for trying to make money. And the animal that the corporation is designed to make a profit. If it doesn't make a profit, it exits the marketplace. So what we have to have in place to counter that are stronger government regulations to tamp down some of the egregious practices that corporations use in order to make those profits. And so one of the ways corporations make profits is to pay workers less, both in the public sector and in the private sector. And as we move more toward a knowledge-based economy, the decisions that are made in government circles as to whether to privatize or not to privatize something are based on data. And the human component in that equation is really extracted. It's just divorced from the whole process. So workers just truly become interchangeable parts in a system. That concept isn't new. Henry Ford developed that back in the early 1900s with interchangeable parts for automobiles, because it made the process of selling a lot of cars in a fixed time period more or easier to do. And so we have now commodified every process in which we produce a good or service in the United States and other major industrial countries as well, so that the goal for corporations now is to make things at less cost that have a short shelf life. Because when you have a system of capitalism based on competition and consumption, you have to use up your resources. You have to continually make things that are consumed. And education is one of those products that is consumed. And it has the terminology we even use now and is used in many government circles when they're talking about funding education or not funding education, reduces it to a manufactured product. Students are the outputs, and the education is the intervention that is used to produce a student who can go into the workforce and make money. We used to do that in the common schools back in the 1800s when we were producing workers to go into agriculture or early factory settings. That concept really hasn't changed. What has changed is that all the decisions now are data-driven. All of the decisions are about how to squeeze as much efficiency out of a process as can be squeezed out of a process, and the fact that individuals are devalued. And the only way they can become valuable again is for that, again, I keep going back to that economic labor management relationship. The only way for employees to be valued again is for them to form some kind of collective which will help them to balance out that very unequal balance of power, economic balance of power in the labor management relationship. So I'm hopeful that as we move forward, both in this country and globally, we will begin to see humans valued again, dignity restored to the workplace, workers having a voice in the workplace, so that folks like the caller, who was a wonderful educator for many, many years, and then became very disgruntled with the process, and as other new human beings decide to become teachers or choose not to become teachers because they are less valued by the system. One of the most important things for a worker to be is valued, to have value in the workplace for themselves and for the good or service that they're producing. It is just really important because there's not a consequence for that is detrimental. If a worker feels valued, he or she will become more efficient, they will produce better, and they are the ones that add value to the product in the first place. Labor can't exist without management, and management can't exist without labor. So they both have to, as we've said for many, many years, get along. But the process by which they get along has made that American dream about which you spoke earlier very elusive for most of the population. It's really an interesting concept if you look at
And Marquita, I'm going to have to step in for a second because we're approaching a break here, and I'm going to give you a chance to finish your thought on the other side. But I want to say to our listeners, if you are just joining us, we are talking about the future of work as part of our ongoing conversation, Chasing the Dream. My guests are Jessica Fraser, who's program manager for the Institute for Working Families, and Marquita Walker, who's with the IUPUI School of Social Work and Labor Studies. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're continuing our conversation called Chasing the Dream that explores issues of poverty and opportunity in America and Indiana. Today, we're talking specifically about the future of work. My guests are Jessica Fraser, who is a program manager for the Institute for Working Families, and Dr. Marquita Walker, who is with the IUPUI School of Social Work in Labor Studies. Marquita, I had to cut you off when we headed to the break. I wanted to give you a chance to wrap up your thought if you wanted to.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Just to try to tie that last thought up, the American dream for most people is very elusive. It used to be that folks, as Jessica had alluded to earlier, could get a good manufacturing job, and they would be a unionized employee. They would make enough money over the course of their career, which usually was a cradle-to-grave career, 30 to 40 years. They would put some money back for retirement. They would pay for a home. They would send their kids to college. And it was a pretty good lifestyle, and that was how the middle class was built. You now do not have cradle-to-grave existence with manufacturing jobs because they have either been moved or overseas or replaced with service sector employment. So workers now can expect to have a 30 to 40 year career, but by holding five or six or seven year jobs. And so the idea behind creating those cradle-to-grave existences was that corporations wanted their employees to stay, and they wanted to build a loyalty between not only the corporation and the customer, but the corporation and the worker. And so they began providing these benefits to them so that workers would stay. Training costs were high. Training costs are still high. But there were corporations that felt that was an important component of the labor-management relationship. That is now pretty much gone. And so as American workers try to find good-paying jobs in this gig or Uber just-in-time economy, they're having difficulty finding that without increased education. And even with increased education, many times, I think the average is 18 months for a student who completes a bachelor's degree in many subjects to find employment in their field. They're faced with increased tuition costs. Many of them are moving back into their families' homes to try to save up enough money so they can have a place of their own. So all of this is driven by legislation on a state and federal level, which again promotes what we call neoliberalism. It promotes the privatization of everything. We've privatized many of our school systems, our prison systems. We've privatized everything. Deunionization, because many people feel that the collective no longer has a place, and it quite frankly has more of a place now than it has ever had. The deregulation of many corporations because it costs money to pay for environmental regulations, to pay for all of that. It costs the corporation a lot of money, so they would just as soon not have to do that. That increases their profit margin. And a really huge component of that is the dehumanization of the worker, just making the worker an interchangeable part in the wheel. So the American dream has just almost become impossible for most people. And that was what I was trying to tie up that last thought.
Okay, great. And I want to pick up on that, Marquita, because I think some of it, and I'm asking this question sort of springing off the first question from Fran that came in, and you've referred to collective or government action or support. How much of this is also a problem that we are still working with late 19th or early 20th century models when it comes to corporations, when it comes to the idea of what work should be? I mean, in theory, you know, and I realize this is something that's going to send probably every part of this discussion, people involved in this discussion off the rail. But if we were to say, for example, okay, healthcare is no longer going to be a private responsibility at any level, meaning corporate or, you know, an individual responsibility. Child care is not going to be. Those are going to be government responsibilities. So, in effect, people can serve as independent contractors in this new working world without having to worry about whether they're going to lose their health insurance, without having to worry about whether they're going to be able to find a place for their children to be during the day. That clearly is not the kind of model that people looked at in the 19th or early 20th centuries, but it might be the one that we have to look at in the 21st century. Jessica?
Well, I think we have to make some good policy decisions to kind of draw lines in the sand of how much of that risk or responsibility should go on to the workers. I mean, I'm thinking about things like workers being responsible for their own workman's comp or paying their own payroll taxes. And how much can we put into, you know, what some people call portable benefit programs? I think about right now across the country, paid family leave is really starting to finally get a toehold in many states. And the way that that's working in most states is to put it as a state function. It's a payroll tax that comes from the employee in most cases. In some states, it's from the employer also, or they share. And those payroll taxes go up to the state, and then the state provides the paid family leave benefit so that low-income moms don't have to go back to work within 10 days of having a child, which is what happens to about 25% of women in this country. So I think that there is a role for the state, and we should decide what those roles are. But at the same time, I don't think we can have 3 million independent contractors, which is the size of our workforce right now. So we have to decide where are the lines and where to draw them, and which pieces of the social contract makes sense for the state to pick up and make portable. And I think retirement is a good option, paid family leave another option.
And I have to interrupt with some breaking news right now, and that is that federal judge Tanya Walton Pratt has granted a preliminary injunction that stops Indiana's new abortion law from going into effect. We're going to have more details here at WFYI as we go forward. But with something that big, I did not want to have our listeners have to wait to get the news. And if you would like more information in addition to listening to this station, please visit WFYI.org to get all of the latest updates. We are talking right now about the future of work here on No Limits as part of our ongoing conversation, Chasing the Dream. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ron has done. Give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. I don't know how you do it, but once again, you've managed to have a show that pushes one of my buttons.
That's what we live for, Ron.
I concur with all the comments that I've heard from your guest and a previous caller. I work in one of the major manufacturing companies in Indianapolis and have for almost 38 years now, United Auto Workers. And as such, I'm a legacy employee, what's known as a legacy employee. In other words, I have the benefits that I've had, the same wages I've had actually for the last 17 years. But now the corporations are hiring what's known as two-tier and sometimes three-tier wage people who come in with a lot less hourly pay, benefits, et cetera. And we on the hourly side of the fence, a study was done years ago, and it was shown that on the hourly side, we actually have more people with bachelor's degrees and master's degrees than they do on the management side. I, in fact, work with a woman who was a professor with a master's degree at Ball State. And back when legacy and wages were still in effect, she quit that job and became an electrician where I work. What many people don't realize that what has happened and what is happening to the American people due to the lack of unions as they drive their Toyotas and Hondas and Kias.
Ron, we're picking up a lot of distortion with your phone line. Are you on a cell? Or are you?
Yes,
that's
I'm
better.
On a cell.
Okay, that's better. That's better. But if you could be quick, because we never know when it'll come back.
All right, thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, the foreign-owned manufacturing companies that the government allowed to enter into this country and replace good American jobs, what most people don't realize, that those non-union shops, if you discuss wages with other employees or discuss wages that are given somewhere else, you can be fired and probably will be. If you have to take off work sick, you can be fired and probably will be. And that's from companies that have no, the employees have no protections of unions. So those are just my comments. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much for the call, Ron. And thank you, as always, for listening.
Sure. Bye.
Certainly. Bye-bye. Marquina, I'm going to throw that one to you first. I'm going to ask everyone, though. I'm starting to get calls and all sorts of stuff stacked up here. So if we could be brief in our questions and our responses, that would be great. Marquita.
Sure. I appreciate that caller. I was IBEW for 30 years, and so I'm out of the building trades. I know exactly what he's talking about. There's a spillover effect from union jobs that increases pay for non-union jobs as well. The unions brought to the workforce things like the 8-hour workday, the weekend, the holidays, the benefits that all workers now enjoy were brought to you by organized labor. And because the hard-fought battles were some years ago, they somehow have kind of dimmed in being highlighted, but they for sure are an important part of the collective history. And it's important for all workers to know that if you are not represented by some kind of a collective, organized labor, a workers association, a work council, or something else, then you are a worker at will. You are, the free will contract means that an employer hires you and can fire you at any time. And you as a laborer can take that job or you can quit at any time. And so the idea behind that is that if a worker accepts a position, then he or she has agreed to abide by the free will contract. What is so detrimental to many of our workers in the service industry is that though they may have accepted a low-paying service sector job and can indeed quit that low-pay service sector job at any time, they have really no other choice but to take another low-paying service sector job. So it's an illusion of choice for many of those who are not represented by a collective bargaining agent.
Got a Facebook question from our regular listener named Gary, and in the interest of time, Gary, I'm going to try to just boil this question down. I'm throwing it your way, Jessica. He's basically saying here, in terms of employment, unemployment numbers, A, can we trust those numbers? And B, you know, particularly if we are developing these independent contract jobs, I mean, how do we even track that sort of stuff now? How do we do that?
Sure. So to answer I'll answer the last part first.
Okay.
The Bureau, U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics is actually working on a contingent employment report. So when that comes out, I think we'll have a much better sense of exactly who is in the contingent workforce, which is another term that some people use for Uber drivers and things like that. Also, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics does surveying of employment, you know, their sense is that folks who are driving for Uber or doing TaskRabbit or things like that are listing themselves as being employed. They're self-reporting that they're employed. It's some of the other things like Airbnb, folks that are getting their living by mm-hmm. running their home as an Airbnb. Those things are, we think, not being captured.
Really hard to track.
They're very hard to track. So, but, you know, one of the things that the employment rate, you know, doesn't always give a good job of showing is people who've dropped out of the labor force, people who've given up looking for work. So that's something to be concerned about. And then the other thing to be concerned about with the most recent jobs numbers is we're still, despite the fact that we have more people working than ever before, we also have a larger population than we mm-hmm. have ever had before. And so while we are creating jobs, and that's a wonderful thing, we are not creating them fast enough to keep up with population change from the beginning of the recession until now. So we still are technically running a little bit of a jobs deficit. So there's work to be done.
We are just about 2 minutes away. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Mark, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you.
Certainly. We're tight for time, so please be quick.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly comment that I'm listening. I think you mentioned the better solution or the better analysis of the problem. It's not that we need more government regulation because profit-hungry corporations are devaluing people. You have to realize we are going through the greatest change in the history of mankind since the Industrial Revolution, brought on by exploding technology, and it's happened at quantum speed. Industrial Revolution happened over 100 years. This is happening in the next 10 to 20. The projections of what's going to happen, the changes in the next 20 years of jobs are going to be absolutely mind-boggling. And the answer isn't regulation. It's for people to take advantage of self-education and decide a path in a more fluid work economy that is inevitable. And if we do that, there's a really positive way to dig out of it, but it's not by saying that the government can do it, because the government's broke. And the average corporation only lasts 10 years now because they can't keep up with the pace of change.
Thanks very much.
That's my blurted, quick response.
Great.
It's a great conversation. I enjoyed listening to it.
Thank you very much for the call, and thank you for listening, Mark. Marquita, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to respond. I know that's not much, but that's all we've got.
Thank you. We are trying currently to conduct an economy under laws and rules that were created in the 1930s. And so we're trying to fit square pegs into round holes. And I do think that there is legislation and regulation that do need to change and be updated to reflect a more fluid working situation for corporations and all workers.
And Jessica, I'm going to give you the same 30 seconds here. I mean, what in terms of Mark's point here that we're going through just this economic revolution,
sure.
Is the problem government regulation or just figuring out other ways perhaps to level the playing field?
I think it's a both and. So okay. We have to decide what we're comfortable with in terms of employees taking on a lot of expense of their benefits. And once we decide that, then we'll know where to go from there.
I'd like to thank my guests, Jessica Fraser and Marquita Walker, for what has been a fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed talking with both of you. Also like to thank our listeners. I apologize for the fact that we couldn't get to all of your questions or comments. Not the last time we're going to talk about this, so please come back. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.